Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Somewhere in North America lives a guy whose nom de guerre is Virtual Renderings, or sometimes Chaz K. We've corresponded by email, and we admire each other's work, it turns out. And someday, I'm going to ask him what his name is. Someday I will. I have reason to believe he lives in Fort Collins, Colorado, but don't quote me on that. Chaz K. puts together marvelous audio collages, each on a certain theme. About 70 are available for free on the Internet, and the show's webpage will give you a link to all of them, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Today we'll hear a recent collage of his called Peasant of the Dawn. I think it's one of his very best. It's about how class inequality and political inequality were engineered into the United States from the beginning. John Madison and other founders saw to that. It's about our current state of eternal warfare and how this helps the ruling elite to rule. It's about how greater equality of wealth would be quite easy to bring about, but doing so would threaten the class hierarchy. Having more than you could possibly eat is much more pleasant when you know that others are going hungry. You'll hear some familiar voices. Howard Zinn, Michael Parenti, Noam Chomsky, Roy Zimmerman, Harry Shearer, and even Ken Nordine, himself a master of the audio collage. The remarks on American exceptionalism and on the city on the hill are by historian Morris Berman. And much of the audio is from a reading of George Orwell's 1984. Orwell wrote that novel in the late 1940s, and it's stunning to see how well he could discern the shape of things to come. To make everything fit, I've cut back a little on some of the songs and other incidental stuff. Let's have a listen to Virtual Renderings' Peasant of the Dawn.
Thought crime.
Afghanistan, Indonesia. There is no other way to deal.
Now, coming up tomorrow, we're going to make some changes. High's probably in the low 80s. There it is. And check this out, a cold front moving in.
What the fuck?
The government lied to you. They used religion to control the poor, you know that? I did. Well, grant more cops. What are you going to steal my sister away from me, too?
It would be kind of nice to be able to hear what goes on, where you think what, a little thoughts, notions,
thought crime,
little whims. Intuition. The vagrancies of your mind.
This notion of American exceptionalism is something that is so strong in our culture, in our education, that it constitutes sort of a fundamental lie that protects the actions of any administration from really, you know, close scrutiny.
Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past.
And then whatever common sense people have is somehow pushed to the side and is taken over by this kind of hysteria about terrorism, and therefore, well, anything we do that the president says against terrorism, I guess, is the right thing to do.
Fixation.
I'm not so sure anymore, am I?
Safety glass, no.
You think of something.
I think there's an important connection, you know, between truth and democracy. You can't really can't really think of your country as a democracy if people don't know the truth. And what we are misinformed about is not just the present, but the past. And that is especially important, because if you're lied to about the past, you're not really in a position to judge what you are told about the present. Then, and anybody in authority can get up in front of the microphone and tell you that we must go to war for this reason or that reason.
I had an idea that nothing fails like success.
I had a similar thought.
You see, someone who builds up an empire of their own.
That nothing succeeds like failure.
A few years later,
what happened?
Totally unknown.
And if you don't know any history, if you don't know anything about our past, you have no basis for challenging what you are being told. So we call ourselves a democracy, and we like to think that it's very simple. And there are the bad states, and there are the good states, and we're the good state. And that kind of sort of Manichaean a division of the world into democracies and not democracies is very, very dangerous, because then those countries which are designated as democracies think that they have a blank check to do whatever they want in the world and it'll be okay.
We're never going to give in.
Thought crime.
Well, I think the founding myth involves things like American exceptionalism, that we were a people chosen by God for a certain type of experiment, that we would be a city on the hill, and that other countries would seek to emulate us and become like us, and that if they didn't, there was something wrong with them. I mean, they were obviously insane or savages or something like this.
God bless America.
People, all parties, all national leaders, all nations believe in their own virtue. But even more so, more than anything else in the world, more than all of these things I've been talking about, they believe with the utmost ferocity, with the utmost dedication, they believe in protecting and advancing their own interests. And they will kill to make sure those interests are advanced.
The men who got together in Philadelphia to frame the Constitution were financially successful planters, slaveholders, merchants, creditors, bankers, and manufacturers. Who else can take 4.5 months off to go sit in Philadelphia and write a Constitution? Many of them were linked to each other by kinship and marriage, and by years of service in Congress or the military or diplomatic service.
The country was founded on the principle that there should be a democratic deficit. That's the Madisonian conception. You look back at the debates in the Constitutional Convention, Madison, of course, the main framer, he argued that, he didn't put it in these terms, but he argued basically that democracy is a bad thing. It's dangerous. We have to make sure that the public doesn't become involved in public affairs. So there should be a democratic deficit.
America!
When the founding fathers, so-called founding fathers, met in Philadelphia, they were determined that persons of birth and fortune and affluence should control the affairs of the nation and check the what they call the leveling impulses of the propertyless multitude that composed the what Madison called a majority faction. James Madison, who played probably the most crucial role in the Constitution, putting the Constitution together, talked about how it was important in his famous Federalist Paper No. 10, how it was important to keep the spirit and form of popular government with only a minimum of the substance. How do you construct a government? And this was the task, he said, that the framers were facing. How do you construct a government that would win some popular support but would not tamper with the existing class structure? A government strong enough to service the growing needs of an entrepreneurial class while withstanding the democratic egalitarian demands of the popular class. And the way you do it is by excluding the popular class from most of the crucial points of power.
Offshore drilling is completely safe. You're getting sleepy. Tax cuts for the rich create new jobs. You're getting sleepy. Financial corporations will police themselves, and illegal aliens are stealing all your pens. Now when I count to three and snap my fingers, you'll awake refreshed and vote Republican.
Well, I tell you, from the outside, when you're looking at the U.S. from the outside, not only from Mexico, but from Europe, from England, whatever, it's a very, very peculiar country. And I've had the discussion with French and English and just other people that they just find it a most peculiar nation. And I personally think that's true. And to that peculiarity has been added the fact that we finally lost our way. I mean, I'm not sure we ever had it.
Snap my fingers, you'll awake confused and vote Republican.
And among the American people, there grew the feeling that the revolution against the English crown had been fought for no good reason.
There still is a desire to save the country, to say that, well, if we do this and that, we will fix things. And my argument is, my friend, you're trying to turn around an aircraft carrier in a bathtub.
Yeah.
That cannot be done. 400 years of history cannot be reversed. We are who we are, and it didn't work out.
We've been warned against offering the people of this nation false hope.
But here's what I think is big, that over the last 2 years, in an emergency situation, our basic attitude was, we got to get some things done. But in order to do that, basically worked with the process as opposed to transform the process. And there's no doubt that that frustrated folks. But yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
But yes, we can. But yes, we can. But yes, we can. But it frustrates me. I think what I would say is,
yeah,
it's not going to happen overnight.
It's not going to happen overnight.
But Larry Summers did a heck of a job. Unintended. But, you know, I'm feeling great about where the American people are considering what we've gone through. We've gone through the two toughest years of any time since the Great Depression. And in light of that, the fact that people have been resilient, that folks are still out there working and opening businesses, you know, working in the community, looking after their families, taking care of their responsibilities, that's encouraging. So there's still a lot of good stuff happening. But yes, we can. But yes, we can. But yes, we can. But
Yes, we can.
People are frustrated. You know, a lot of folks are hurting out there still. And, you know, in that environment, I think that they're hoping that we can do a little bit better here in Washington than we've been doing.
But
yes, we can. But yes, we can. But
can, but yes we can, but.
What kind of people would control this world has been equally obvious. The new aristocracy was made up for the most part of bureaucrats, scientists, technicians, trade union organizers, publicity experts, sociologists, teachers, journalists, and professional politicians. These people, whose origins lay in the salaried middle class and the upper grades of the working class, had been shaped and brought together by the barren world of monopoly industry and centralized government. As compared with her opposite numbers in past ages, they were less avaricious, less tempted by luxury, hungrier for pure power, and above all, more conscious of what they were doing and more intent on crushing opposition. This last difference was cardinal. By comparison with that existing today, all the tyrannies of the past were half-hearted and inefficient. The ruling groups were always infected to some extent by liberal ideas and were content to leave loose ends everywhere, to regard only the overt act and to be uninterested in what their subjects were thinking. In the past, no government had the power to keep its citizens under constant surveillance. The invention of print, however, made it easier to manipulate public opinion, and the film and the radio carried the process further. With the development of television and the technical advance which made it possible to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same instrument, private life came to an end. The possibility of enforcing not only complete obedience to the will of the state, but complete uniformity of opinion on all subjects, now existed for the first time.
Welcome to intermission.
And if you are wondering what the heck you're listening to, this is the audio collage Peasant of the Dawn by Virtual Renderings, rebroadcast on New World Notes. Why? Because we like you. Yes, that previous song, Yes We Can, But, was a duet featuring Harry Shearer and Barack H. Obama. This collage is all about hierarchy, social control, political control, and the subversion of democracy, with an increasing portion of the audio a reading of George Orwell's great 1984. On we go!
From the moment when the machine first made its appearance, it was clear to all thinking people that the need for human drudgery, and therefore to a great extent for human inequality, had disappeared. If the machine were used deliberately for that end, hunger, overwork, dirt, illiteracy, and disease could be eliminated within a few generations. And, in fact, without being used for any such purpose but by a sort of automatic process, by producing wealth which it was sometimes impossible not to distribute, the machine did raise the living standards of the average human being very greatly over a period of about 50 years at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries.
It's kind of ironic. Technology's progressed so far now, we don't even know what's real and what's an idea anymore.
It was also clear that an all-round increase in wealth threatened the destruction, indeed in some sense was the destruction, of a hierarchical society. In a world in which everyone worked short hours, had enough to eat, lived in a house with a bathroom and a refrigerator, and possessed a motor car or even an airplane, the most obvious and perhaps the most important form of inequality would already have disappeared. If it once became general, wealth would confer no distinction. It was possible, no doubt, to imagine a society in which wealth, in the sense of personal possessions and luxury, should be evenly distributed, while power remained in the hands of a small privileged caste. But in practice, such a society could not long remain stable. For if leisure and security were enjoyed by all alike, the great mass of human beings who are normally stupefied by poverty would become literate and would learn to think for themselves. And when once they had done this, they would sooner or later realize that the privileged minority had no function, and they would sweep it away.
Let us all agree. Let us not dissent. Let us not ask questions such as where our freedoms went. We'll just fly the flag, sing God Bless America. Question people's patriotism who don't join in the hysteria.
Physical rebellion, or any preliminary move toward rebellion, is at present not possible. From the proletarians, nothing is to be feared. Left to themselves, they will continue from generation to generation and from century to century, working, breeding, and dying, not only without any impulse to rebel, but without the power of grasping that the world could be other than it is. They could only become dangerous if the advance of industrial technique made it necessary to educate them more highly. But since military and commercial rivalry are no longer important, the level of popular education is actually declining. What opinions the masses hold or do not hold is looked on as a matter of indifference. They can be granted intellectual liberty because they have no intellect. War, it will be seen, not only accomplishes the necessary destruction, but accomplishes it in a psychologically acceptable way. In principle, it would be quite simple to waste the surplus labor of the world by building temples and pyramids, by digging holes and filling them up again, or even by producing vast quantities of goods and then setting fire to them. But this would provide only the economic and not the emotional basis for a hierarchical society. What is concerned here is not the morale of the masses, whose attitude is unimportant so long as they are kept steadily at work, but the morale of the party itself. Even the humblest party member is expected to be competent, industrious, and even intelligent within narrow limits. But it is also necessary that he should be a credulous and ignorant fanatic, whose prevailing moods are fear, hatred, adulation, and orgiastic triumph. In other words, it is necessary that he should have the mentality appropriate to a state of war. It does not matter whether the war is actually happening. And since no decisive victory is possible, it does not matter whether the war is going well or badly. All that is needed is that a state of war should exist. The splitting of the intelligence which the party requires of its members, and which is more easily achieved in an atmosphere of war, is now almost universal. But the higher up the ranks one goes, the more marked it becomes. It is precisely in the inner party that war hysteria and hatred of the enemy are strongest. In his capacity as an administrator, it is often necessary for a member of the inner party to know that this or that item of war news is untruthful, and he may often be aware that the entire war is spurious and is either not happening or is being waged for purposes quite other than the declared ones. But such knowledge is easily neutralized by the technique of doublethink. Meanwhile, no inner party member wavers for an instant in his mystical belief that the war is real and that it is bound to end victoriously.
I'm getting old, my son, my days are nearly done. And I want to leave this world with nothing left undone. But my time is running fast, and with each breath may be my last. So I'll give to you now the gift my father, he once passed. Where the peasants of the peace, the peasants of the dawn. Yeah, the love becomes priceless when the money's all gone. Peasants of the dawn. Well, the plan for us is global, some would say ignoble. But the world's judgment moves us not at all. Here, for centuries we've created the world we favor. Where our rule is total and the population small. Well, they're peasants of the peace, they're just peasants of the dawn. Here's their love becomes priceless when the money's all gone. Peasants of the dawn. We the new aristocrats have no need of teeming peasant brats. They add nothing to the mix, use our oil by the vats. For the calling is beginning, our heady plans are spinning. Generations underground, and we rebuild the world we've so carefully despoiled. So my son, take our message to the lonely, useless eaters of the globe. We the masters of the world need only wait a few more years, and then there will be none to cop or criticize or peer into our rule. Those alive will be our abject slaves, you among the masters, reigning evermore through all the coming years. Through all the coming years. They're just peasants of the peace, they're peasants of the dawn. Love becomes priceless when the money's all gone. Peasants of the dawn.
He had committed the essential crime that contained all others in itself. Thought crime, they called it. Thought crime was not a thing that could be concealed forever. You might dodge successfully for a while, even for years, but sooner or later they were bound to get you. It was always at night. The arrests invariably happened at night. The sudden jerk out of sleep, the rough hand shaking your shoulder, the lights glaring in your eyes, the ring of hard faces round the bed. In the vast majority of cases, there was no trial, no report of the arrest. People simply disappeared, always during the night. Your name was removed from the register. Every record of everything you had ever done was wiped out. Your one-time existence was denied and then forgotten. You were abolished, annihilated, vaporized, was the usual word.
This show ain't no good.
Hello?
Unfortunately, you and I have run out of time. They're coming for you, and I don't know what they're going to do.
Can you hear me? Stay calm. Everything will be all right. The door seems to be jammed. Please check the lock on your side.
Everything will be all right. We are here to help you. Stay calm. Everything will be all right.
And with those words from Orwell's 1984 ends Virtual Rendering's most excellent sound collage, Peasant of the Dawn. You've heard maybe 94% of it. For a link to the complete uncut version online, go to radioforall.net and search, or, even easier, go to newworldnotes.blogspot.com for a direct link. New World Notes comes to you from the East of the River Satellite Studios and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thanks to Virtual Renderings, Chaz K. for his great work. Thanks to you for listening. It'll get to my non-carborundum. Keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.